the dark organ music filled the Department of Post-Mortem Communications. Moist assumed it was all part of the ambiance, although the mood would have been more precisely obtained if the tune it was playing did not appear to be cantata and fugue for someone who has trouble with the pedals. As the last note died after a long illness, Dr. Hicks spun around on the stool and raised the mask. "Sorry about that. I have two left feet sometimes. Could you both just chant a bit while I do the mystic waving, please? Don't worry about words. Anything seems to work if it sounds sepulchral enough." As he walked around the circle, chanting variants on ooh and rah, Moist wondered how many bankers raised the dead during the course of an afternoon. Probably not a high number. He shouldn't be doing this, surely. He should be out there making money. Al's clamp must have finished the design by now. He could be holding his first note in his hands by tomorrow. And then there was damned Cribbins, who could be talking to anyone. True, the man had a rap sheet as long as a roller towel, but the city worked by alliances, and if he met up with the Lavishes, then Moist's life would unravel all the way back to the gallows.
"In my day, we at least hired a decent mask," growled an elderly voice. "I say, is that a woman over there?"
A figure had appeared in the circle without any bother or fuss apart from the grumbling. It was, in every respect, the picture of a wizard, robed, pointy-hatted, bearded, and elderly, with the addition of a silvery monochrome effect overall and some slight transparency.
"Ah, Professor Fleed," said Hicks. "It's kind of you to join us."
"You know, you brought me here, and it's not as if I had anything else to do," said Fleed.
He turned back to Adora Bell, and his voice became pure syrup.
"What is your name, my dear?"
"Adora Bell, dear heart." The warning tone of voice was lost on Fleed.
"How delightful," he said, giving her a gummy smile.
Regrettably, this made little strings of saliva vibrate in his mouth like the web of a very old spider.
"And would you believe me if I told you that you bear a striking resemblance to my beloved concubine, Fenty, who died more than 300 years ago? The likeness is astounding."
"I'd say that was a pick-up line," said Adora Bell.
"Oh, dear, such cynicism," sighed the late Fleed,
turning to the head of post-mortem communications.
"Apart from this young lady's wonderful chanting, it was frankly a mess, Hicks," he said sharply.
He tried to pat Adora Bell's hand, but his fingers passed right through.
"I'm sorry, Professor. We just don't get the funding these days," said Hicks.
"I know, I know. It was ever thus, Doctor. Even in my day. If you needed a corpse, you had to go out and find your own. If you couldn't find one, you jolly well had to make one. It's all so nice now. So damned correct. So a fresh egg technically does the trick. Well, whatever happened to style? They tell me they've made an engine that can think now, but of course the fine arts are always the last in the queue. So I'm brought to this. One barely competent post-mortem communicator, and two people from central groaning."
"Necromancy is a fine art," said Moist.
"None finer, young man. Get things just a tiny bit wrong, and the spirits of the vengeful dead may enter your head via your ears and blow your brains out down your nose."
The eyes of Moist and Adora Bell focused on Dr. Hicks, like those of an archer on his target. He waved his hands frantically and mouthed, "Not very often."
"What is a pretty young woman like you doing here,
said Fleed, trying to grab Adora Bell's hand again.
"I'm trying to translate a phrase from Omnian," she said, giving him a wooden smile and absent-mindedly wiping her hand on her dress.
"Are women allowed to do that sort of thing these days? What fun! One of my greatest regrets, you know, is that when I was in possession of a body, I didn't let it spend enough time in the company of young ladies."
Moist looked around to see if there was any kind of emergency lever. There had to be something, if only in the event of nasal brain explosion. He sidled up to Hicks. "It's going to go really bad in a moment," he hissed.
"It's all right. I can banish him to the undead zone in a moment,"
Hicks whispered. "That won't be far enough if she loses her temper. I once saw her put a stiletto heel right through a man's foot while she was smoking a cigarette. She hasn't had a cigarette for more than 15 minutes, so there's no telling what she'll do." But Adora Bell had pulled the golem's arm out of her bag, and the late Professor Fleed's eyes twinkled with something more compelling than romance. Lust comes in many varieties. He picked up the arm. That was the second surprising thing, and then Moist realized that the arm was still there by Fleed's feet, and what he was lifting was a pearly, tenuous ghost.
"Ah, part of an Omnian golem," he said. "Bad condition. Immensely rare. probably dug up on the site of yes?
Possibly, said Adora Bell.
Possibly, eh? Said Fleed, turning the spectral arm around. Look at the wafer thinness. Light as a feather, but strong as steel while the fire's burned within. There's been nothing like them since.
I might know where such fires still burn, said Adora Bell.
After 60,000 years, I think not, madam.
I think otherwise. She could say things in that tone of voice and turn heads. She projected absolute certainty. Moist had worked hard for years to get a voice like that.
Are you saying an Umnian golem has survived?
Yes, four of them, I think, said Adora Bell.
Can they sing?
At least one can.
I'd give anything to see one before I die, said Fleed.
Moist began.
Figure of speech, said Fleed, waving a hand irritably.
I think that could be arranged, said Adora Bell.
In the meantime, we've transcribed their song into Bodley's phonetic runes.
She dipped into her bag and produced a small scroll. Fleed reached out, and once again, an iridescent ghost of the scroll was now in his hands.
It appears to be gibberish, he said, glancing at it. Although I have to say that Umnian always does at first glance. I shall need some time to work it out. Umnian is entirely a contextual language. Have you seen these golems?
No. Our tunnel collapsed. We can't even talk to the golems who are digging anymore. Song doesn't travel well under salt water. But we think they're unusual golems.
Golden, probably, said Fleed,
the words leaving a thoughtful silence in their wake. Then Adora Bell said, Oh. Moist shut his eyes. On the inside of the lids, the gold reserves of Ankh Morpork walked up and down, gleaming.
Anyone who researches finds the golden golem legend, said Fleed. 60,000 years ago, some witch doctor sitting by a fire made a clay figure and worked out how to make it live, and that was the only invention they ever needed, do you understand? They even had horse golems, do you know that? No one has ever been able to create one since. Yet the Umnians never worked iron. They never invented a spade or a wheel. Golems herded their animals and spun their cloth. The Umnians did make their own jewellery, though, which largely consisted of scenes of human sacrifice badly executed in every sense of the word. They were incredibly inventive in that area. A theocracy, of course, he added with a shrug. I don't know what it is about stepped pyramids that brings out the worst in a god. Anyway, yes, they did work gold. They dressed their priests in it. Quite possibly they made a few golems out of it. Or equally, the golden golems was a metaphor referring to the value of golems to the Umnians. When people wish to express the concept of worth, gold is always the word of choice.
Isn't it just, murmured Moist.
Or it is simply a legend without foundation. Exploration of the site has never found anything except a few fragments of broken golems, said Fleed, sitting back and making himself comfortable on empty air.
He winked at Adora Bell.
Perhaps you looked elsewhere. One story tells us that upon the death of all the humans, the golems walked into the sea?
The question mark hung in the air like the hook it was. What an interesting story, said Adora Bell, poker-faced. Fleed smiled.
I will find the sense of this message. Of course you will come and see me again tomorrow. You make eternity bearable.
Moist didn't like the sound of that, whatever it was. It didn't help that Adora Bell was smiling. Fleed added,
Why do you care about golems? They have no passionate parts.
Have you, sir? Said Adora Bell, laughing.
No, but I have an excellent memory.
Moist frowned. He liked it better when she was giving the old devil the cold shoulder. Can we go now? He said. Probationary trainee junior clerk Hammersmith Coote watched Miss Drapes looming ever closer, with slightly less apprehension than his older colleagues did, and they knew this was because the poor kid had not been there long enough to know the meaning of what was about to happen. The senior clerk put the paper on his desk with some force. The total had been ringed around in green ink, which was still wet. "Mr. Bent," she said, with a tincture of satisfaction, "says you must do this again, properly." And because Hammersmith was a well-brought-up young man, and because this was only his first week in the bank, he said, "Yes, Miss Drapes," took the paper neatly, and set to work. There were many different stories told about what happened next. In years to come, clerks measured their banking experience in how close they were when the thing happened. There were disagreements on what was actually said. Certainly there was no violence, no matter what some of the stories implied. But it was a day that brought the world, or at least that part of it that included the counting house, to its knees. Everyone agreed that Hammersmith spent some time working on the percentages. They say he produced a notebook, a personal notebook, which was an offence in itself, and did some work in it. Then, after, some say 15 minutes, some say nearly half an hour, he walked back to the desk of Miss Drapes and declared, "I'm sorry, Miss Drapes, but I can't find where the mistake is. I have checked my workings and believe my total is correct." His voice was not loud, but the room went silent. In fact, it was more than silent. The sheer straining of hundreds of ears meant spiders spinning cobwebs near the ceiling wobbled in the oral suction. He was sent back to his desk to do it again and don't waste people's time. And after a further 10 minutes, some say 15, Miss Drapes went to his desk and looked over his shoulder. Most people agree that after half a minute or so, she picked up the paper, pulled a pencil from the tight bun on the back of her head, ordered the young man out of his seat, sat down, and spent some time staring at the numbers. She got up. She went to the desk of another senior clerk. Together, they pored over the piece of paper. A third clerk was summoned. He copied out the offending columns, worked on them for a while, and looked up, his face grey. No one needed to say it aloud. By now, all work had stopped, but Mr. Bent, up on the high stool, was still engrossed in the numbers before him, and, significantly, he was muttering under his breath. People sensed it in the air. Mr. Bent had made a mistake. The most senior clerks conferred hastily in a corner. There was no higher authority that they could appeal to. Mr. Bent was the higher authority, second only to the inexorable Lord of Mathematics. In the end, it was left to the luckless Miss Drapes, who so recently had been the agent of Mr. Bent's displeasure, to write on the document, "I'm sorry, Mr. Bent, I believe the young man is right." She slipped this at the bottom of a number of working sheets that she was delivering to the in-tray, dropped it in as the tray rumbled past, and then the sound of her little boots echoed as she rushed, weeping the length of the hall to the ladies' restroom, where she had hysterics. The remaining members of the staff looked around warily, like ancient monsters who can see a second sun getting bigger in the sky but have absolutely no idea what they should do about it. Mr. Bent was a fast man with an in-tray, and by the look of it, there were about 2 minutes or less before he was confronted with the message. Suddenly, and all at once, they fled for the exits. "And how was that for you?" said Moist, stepping out into the sunlight. "Do I detect a note of peevishness?" said Adorabelle. "Well, my plans for today did not include dropping in to chat with a 300-year-old lech." "I think you mean lich. And anyway, he was a ghost, not a corpse. He was leching." "All in his mind," said Adorabelle. "Your mind, too. Normally you go crazy if people try to patronise you." "True. But most people aren't able to translate a language so old that even golems can hardly understand a tenth of it. Get a talent like that, and it could be you getting the girls when you're 3 centuries dead." "You were just flirting to get what you wanted." Adorabelle stopped dead in the middle of the square to confront him. "And? You flirt with people all the time? You flirt with the whole world? That's what makes you interesting. Because you're more like a musician than a thief. You want to play the world, especially the fiddly bits. And now I'm going home for a bath. I got off the coach this morning, remember?" "This morning," said Moist, "I found that one of my staff had swapped the mind of another of my staff with that of a turnip." "Was that good?" said Adorabelle. "I'm not sure. In fact, I'd better go and check. Look, we've both had a busy day. I'll send a cab at 7:30, all right?" Cribbins was enjoying himself. He'd never been much for reading up until now. Oh, he could read, and write, too, in a nice, cursive script that people thought was quite distinguished. And he'd always liked the Times for its clear, readable font, and had, with the aid of some scissors and a pot of paste, often accepted its assistance in producing those missives that attract attention not by fine writing, but by having the messages set out in cut-out words and letters, and even whole phrases if you were lucky. Reading for pleasure had passed him by, however. But he was reading now, oh yes, and it was extremely pleasurable, goodness yes. It was amazing what you could find if you knew what you were looking for. And now all his hog's watches were about to come at once.
"A cup of tea, Reverend," said a voice by his side.
It was the plump lady in charge of the Times's back issues department, who had taken to him as soon as he doffed his hat to her. She had the slightly wistful, slightly hungry look that so many women of a certain age wore when they decided to trust in gods because of the absolute impossibility of continuing to trust in men.
"Why, thank you, sister," he said, beaming. "And is it not written, the Eleemosynary cup is more worthy than the throne hen?"
Then he noticed the discreet little silver ladle pinned to her bosom, and that her earrings were two tiny spatulas. The holy symbols of annoyer, yes. He'd just been reading about annoyer in the religious pages. All the rage these days, thanks to the help of young Spangler. Started out way down the ladder as the goddess of things that get stuck in drawers, but the talk in the religious pages was that she was being tipped for goddess of lost causes, a very profitable area. Very profitable indeed for a man with a flexible approach, but, and he sighed inwardly, it was not such a good idea to do business when the god in question was active, in case Annoya got angry and found a new use for a spatula. Besides, he'd soon be able to put all that behind him. What a clever lad young Spangler had turned out to be, smarmy little devil. This wasn't going to be over quick, oh no. This was going to be a pension for life, and it'd be a long, long life, or else.
"Is there anything more I can get you, Reverend?" said the woman anxiously.
"My cup runneth over, sister," said Cribbins.
The woman's anxious expression intensified. "Oh, I'm sorry, I hope it hasn't gone on the—" Cribbins carefully put his hand over the cup.
"I meant that I am more than satisfied," he said.
And he was. It was a bloody miracle, that's what it was. If Om was going to hand them out like this, he might even start believing in him. And it got better the more you thought about it, Cribbins told himself, as the woman hurried away. Had the kid done it? There must have been cronies. The hangman, for one. A couple of jailers. Reflectively, he removed his false teeth with a twang, swilled them gently in the tea, patted them dry with his handkerchief, and wrestled them back into his mouth a few seconds before footsteps told him the woman was returning. She was positively vibrating with genteel courage.
"Excuse me, Reverend, but can I ask a favour?" she said, going pink.
Cribbins turned his back, and against a chorus of snaps and twangs, dragged the wretched dentures around the right way. Damned things! Why'd he ever bother to leave them out of the old man's mouth, he'd never know.
"I do beg your pardon, sister, a little dental mishap there,"
he murmured, turning back and dabbing at his mouth.
"Pray continue."
"It's funny you should say that, Reverend," said the woman, her eyes bright with nervousness, "because I belong to a small group of ladies who run, well, a God of the Month club. That is, we pick a god and believe in him, or her, obviously, or it, although we draw the line at the ones with teeth and too many legs, and the foreign ones, of course, and then we pray to them for a month, and then we sit down and discuss it. Well, there's so many, aren't there? Thousands. We've not really considered Om, though, but if you would care to give us a little talk next Tuesday, I'm sure we'll be happy to give him a jolly good try."
Springs pinged as Cribbins gave her a huge smile.
"What is your name, sister?"
he asked.
"Berenice," she said. "Berenice Hauser."
Ah, no longer using the bastard's name, very wise, thought Cribbins.
"What a wonderful idea, Berenice," he said. "I would consider it a pleasure."
She beamed.
"There wouldn't be any biscuits, would there, Berenice?"
Cribbins added. Miss Hauser blushed.
"Oh, I believe I have some chocolate one somewhere," she volunteered,
as if letting him in on a big secret.
"May annoyer rattle your drawers, sister," said Cribbins to her retreating back.
Wonderful, he thought, as she bustled off, blushing and happy. He tucked his notebook into his jacket and sat back and listened to the ticking of the clock on the wall and the gentle snores of the beggars, who were the normal habitués of this office on a hot afternoon. All was peaceful, settled, organised, just like life ought to be. It was going to be the gravy boat for him from this day forward, if he was very, very careful.
Moist ran down the length of the vaults toward the brilliant light at the far end. There was a tableau of peacefulness. Hubert was standing in front of the glooper, occasionally tapping a pipe. Igor was blowing some curious glass creation over his little forge, and Mr. Clamp, formerly known as Owlswick Jenkins, was sitting at his desk with a faraway look on his face. Moist sensed the doom ahead. Something was wrong. It might not be even a particular thing, it was just a sheer platonic wrongness, and he did not like Mr. Clamp's expression at all. Nevertheless, the human brain, which survives by hoping from one second to another, will always endeavour to put off the moment of truth. Moist approached the desk, rubbing his hands together.
"How's it going, then, Owl—" "I mean, Mr. Clamp," he said. "Finished it yet, have we?"
"Oh, yes," said Clamp, a strange, mirthless little smile on his face. "Here it is."
On the desk in front of him was the other side of the first proper dollar bill ever to be designed. Moist had seen pictures quite like it, but they had been when he was 4 years old, in nursery school. The face of what was presumably meant to be Lord Veterinari had two dots for eyes and a broad grin. The panorama of the vibrant city of Ankh-Morpork appeared to consist of a lot of square houses with a window, all square, in each corner and a door in the middle.
"I think it's one of the best things I've ever done," said Clamp.
Moist patted him convivially on the shoulder and then marched toward Igor, who was already looking defensive.
"What have you done to that man?" said Moist.
"I have made him a well-balanced personality, no longer beset with anxieties, fears, and the demons of paranoia," said Igor.
Moist glanced at Igor's workbench, a brave thing to do by any standards. On it was a jar with something indistinct floating in it. Moist looked closer. Another minor act of heroism when you were in an Igor-rich environment. It was not a happy turnip. It was blotchy. It was bouncing, gently from one side of the jar to another, occasionally turning over.
"I see," said Moist. "But it would appear, regrettably, that by giving our friend the relaxed and hopeful attitude toward life of, not to put too fine a point on it, a turnip, you have also given him the artistic abilities of, and I have no hesitation in using the term again, a turnip."
"But he is much happier in himself," said Igor.
"Granted, but how much of himself is, and I really don't wish to keep repeating myself here, of a root vegetable-like nature?"
Igor considered this for some time.
"As a medical man, sir," he said, "I must consider what is best for the patient. At the moment, he is happy and content, and hath no cares in the world. Why would he give up all this for a mere facility with a pencil?"
Moist was aware of an insistent bonk, bonk. It was the turnip banging itself against the side of the jar.
"That is an interesting and philosophical point," he said, once again looking at Clamp's happy yet somewhat unfocused expression. "But it seems to me that all those nasty little details were what made him, well, him."
The frantic banging of the vegetable grew louder. Igor and Moist stared from the jar to the eerily smiling man.
"Igor, I'm not sure you know what makes people tick."
Igor gave an avuncular little chuckle.
"Oh, believe me, sir."
"Igor," said Moist.
"Yes, master,"
said Igor gloomily.
"Go and fetch the damn wires again, will you?"
"Yes, master."
Moist got back upstairs again to find himself in the middle of a panic. A tearful Miss Drapes spotted him and click-clicked over at speed.
"It's Mr. Bent, sir. He just rushed out, yelling. We can't find him anywhere."
"Why are you looking?" said Moist, and then realised he said it aloud. "I meant, what is the reason for you looking?"
The story unfolded. As Miss Drapes talked, Moist got the impression that all the other listeners were getting the point, and he wasn't.
"So, okay. He made a mistake," he said.
No harm done, is there? It's all been sorted out, right? A bit embarrassing, I dare say. But, he reminded himself, an error is worse than a sin, isn't it? But that's just plain daft, his sensible self pointed out. He could have said something like, "You see, even I can make a mistake through a moment's inattention. We must be forever vigilant." Or he could have said, "I did this on purpose to test you." Even schoolteachers know that one. I can think of half a dozen ways to wriggle out of something like that. But then, I'm a wriggler. I don't think he's ever wriggled in his life.
"I hope he hasn't done something silly," said Miss Drapes,
fishing a crumpled handkerchief out of a sleeve. Something silly, thought Moist. That's the phrase people used when they were thinking about someone jumping into the river, or taking the entire contents of the medicine box in one go. Silly things like that. "I've never met a less silly man," he said.
"Well, we've always wondered about him, to be honest," said a clerk. "I mean, he's in at dawn, and one of the cleaners told me he's often in here late at night."
What? That hurt!"
Miss Drapes, who had nudged him hard, now whispered urgently in his ear. The man deflated and looked awkwardly at Moist.
"Sorry, sir, I spoke out of turn," he mumbled.
"Mr. Bent is a good man, Mr. Litwig," said Miss Drapes. "He drives himself hard."
"Drives all of you hard, it seems to me," said Moist. This attempt at solidarity with the labouring masses didn't seem to hit the mark.
"If you can't stand the heat, get off the pot, that's what I say," said a senior clerk, and there was a general murmur of agreement.
"I think you get out of the kitchen," said Moist. "Get off the pot is the alternative when—"
"Half the chief cashiers and the planes have worked in this room," said Miss Drapes, "and quite a few managers now, and Miss Lee, who's deputy manager of Apsley's commercial bank in Stowlet, she got the job because of the letter Mr. Bent wrote. Bent trained, you see. That counts for a lot. If you've got a reference from Mr. Bent, you can walk into any bank and get a job with a snap of your fingers."
"And if you stay, the pay here is better than anywhere," a clerk put in. "He told the board if they want the best, they'd have to pay for it."
"Oh, he's demanding," said another clerk. "But I hear they're all working for a human resources manager at Pipeworth's bank now, and if it comes to that, I'll take Mr. Bent any day of the week. At least he thinks I'm a person. I was hearing where she was timing how long people spent in the privy."
"They call it time and motion study," said Moist. "Look, I expect Mr. Bent just wants to be alone for a while. Who was he yelling at? The lad who made a mistake? Or didn't make it, I mean?"
"That was young Hammersmith," said Miss Drapes. "We sent him home because he was in a bit of a state. And no, he wasn't really shouting at him. He wasn't really shouting at anybody. He was—"
She paused, searching for a word.
"Gibberin," said the clerk, who had spoken out of turn, giving the turn another twist.
"And you don't all have to look at me like that. You all heard him, and he looked as though he'd seen a ghost."
Clerks were wandering back into the counting house in ones and twos. They'd searched everywhere, was the general agreement, and there was a strong support for the theory that he'd gone out through the mint, it being rather busy in there with all the work still going on. Moist doubted it. The bank was old, and old buildings have all sorts of crannies, and Mr. Bent had been here for— how long has he been here? He wondered aloud. The general consensus was, since the mind of man can remember, but Miss Drapes, who seemed for some reason to have made herself well informed on the subject of Malvolio Bent, volunteered that it was 39 years, and he got a job when he was 13 by sitting on the steps all night until the chairman came to work and impressing him with his command of numbers. He went from messenger boy to chief cashier in 20 years.
"Speedy," said Moist.
"Never had a day off for illness either," Miss Drapes concluded.
"Well, perhaps he's entitled to some now," said Moist. "Do you know where he lives, Miss Drapes?"
"Mrs. Cake's boarding house."
"Really? That's a bit—"
Moist stopped and chose from a number of options.
"Low rent, isn't it?" "He says that as a bachelor it meets his needs," said Miss Drapes, and avoided Moist's gaze.
Moist could feel the day slipping away from him, but they were all staring at him. There was only one thing he could say if he was to maintain his image.
"Then I think I ought to see if he's gone there," said Moist.
Their faces broke into smiles of relief.
He added, "But I think that one of you should come with me. After all, you know him."
"It looks as though I don't," he thought.
"I'll fetch my coat,"
said Miss Drapes. The only reason that her words came out at the speed of sound was that she couldn't make them go any faster.